Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, did you know that the price of baby formula is shooting up? Is the stigma around bottle feeding stopping us having a proper conversation about why these price hikes are happening? And do you feel tuned in to what's going on in the world? I'll be meeting author and TEDx speaker Nuala Walsh, who's calling for more focus in a noisy world to aid our decision making. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, I'm happy to report that I did move at a slower pace this week, really focused on resting more and taking it easier. Obviously, there were still demands on my time, but my attitude was different. We can't keep going at breakneck speed much as we try. I heard dietitian Sarah Keogh speak at an event recently, and she was talking about our pets, our dogs and our cats who watch us owners rush around. Because when they're tired, they rest. Now, obviously, they don't have jobs and mortgages. I get it. But we really are the only species who push on when we're tired. So this week, I aimed where I could to stretch out like a cat. However, I do have a big surge of energy on the way that I want to share with you. So there have been some training hikes and gym sessions as usual. I've just been announced as the Focus Ireland ambassador for their On the Move campaign this year to help raise much needed funds in the fight against homelessness. On the weekend of the 14th to the 16th of June, you can get involved by joining in on one of their organised hikes. I'm going to be taking on Ireland's highest peak, Carrin Tuathail, on Saturday the 15th. Love to see you there if you're living in the area or fancy travelling down. Or across, depending on where you are. They are also holding a hike up Crowpatrick on Sunday the 16th. But over that same weekend, you can organise any moving event you fancy on your own, with friends, around your local park, on your bike, or something more adventurous. For more information and to register, go to focusireland.ie and click the On the Move button. I have links on my Instagram too. So I and anyone taking part are probably going to need some hiking advice if hike is your chosen poison. And I am joined on the line by one of my favourite guides, Elaine Nick Raymond of Shulin, to get some tips and advice.
Thank you so much, Claire.
It's last year that we hiked together, so we're going to have to get on a hill somewhere. You can't join me in Carrin Tuathail. You're out of the country, but you're here to give me and anyone else who's going to join in On the Move campaign for Focus Ireland on the 14th to the 16th of June. So what's your advice between now and then? What sort of preparation should people be doing if they're going to take on one of the big hikes?
Well, first and foremost, before we start, I just can't wait to have you down to the southeast because there's so much to offer down here. So prepping for a little mini expedition or hike this summer, I'd have to start with the right gear, Claire. So you want to be comfortable, and obviously the gear that's designed for mountaineering are designed with comfort in mind. So having maybe a light rain jacket, good quality boots, so your feet can breathe, that you're not cutting the ankles off yourself as you hike up the mountain. When we hike, we want to kind of control our temperature. So that means we'd strip off, we'd stop, we'd take off a layer, and then if we're getting a bit cooler, if we feel cold in any way, we'd stop again and we put on a layer of clothing. So just bearing that in mind, so thinking, okay, what am I going to pack for my hike? Do I have layers? As we go up the mountain and at greater heights, it gets colder and windier. So we want maybe a down jacket or even a fleece in the summer to put on so we can enjoy our snacks at the top of the mountain and just feel comfortable on the day.
Yeah, because your temperature does change, as you say. You know, you feel really hot as you're going up an incline. Then you might stop for a break. The coldness sets in. So you really do need some choice.
Absolutely. And people can be quite nervous about going out on hikes. You know, like, oh, will I be able for this? But don't forget the first couple of kilometres or the initial part of the hike, our bodies haven't warmed up yet. So that's actually the hardest part. So just to kind of keep a steady pace and then have your layers in mind. So I am a proud ambassador of 53 Degrees North, and that's where I'd go for my gear. But the shops all around the country, and they're happy to chat, to try on things. But definitely good quality footwear and a layering system would be my first tip on the list.
So people often think runners are okay, but you do need the proper hiking boots.
For the likes of Karen Toohill, I'd say get good quality ankle support. So you want to protect your ankles. If you hyperextend your knee or you're kind of going into scrambling mode, that's where you might, you know, have 3 points of contact where you put one or two hands on the rock. Just, you know, it's nothing, you don't need ropes, but it's a little bit more technical than walking on a flatter gradient. You want to have good quality ankle support. So I'd be suggesting or advising everyone to get a good hiking boot for the likes of the Reeks in Kerry.
Do I or anybody planning on joining, you know, Crowpatrick is on the Sunday, I'll be going up Karen Toohill on the 15th of June, but anybody can hike or move in any way that suits them. But if it is a bigger challenge, like one of the big peaks, is there training we should be doing over the next few weeks?
Yes, for sure. So like 2 weeks ago, I ran an ultra marathon in Waterville. It was fabulous. But I prep for that. And in terms of big hikes as well, you know, over the next maybe 2 weekends, 3 weekends, that you could get out of the weekend, put on a weighted bag and just add in some elevation. And that could be a local Caolte forest. It could be, you don't have to drive far for that, but just adding an elevation or finding a loop that you get some hill repeats. And you just clock the miles into your legs. But as I've been out with you before, and again, when you're with a big group, you feed off the energy of that group. You know, you're eating lots of jellies, you're stopping for water breaks. It's very social. You laugh, you know, and there's no issue about saying, look, I need a breather here. I'm not comfortable. And mountain leaders and people who take groups out are very, they're used to dealing with that, and there's no shame, you know. So I always say, if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, you go together.
That's a really lovely way of putting it. And I remember on the hike, the News Talk hike we did last year, yourself, Shu Lin led, and Cara Byrne, the hike psych. And I really noticed, compared to when I go with friends, we stopped a lot more. And I think it's really important. It gives everyone permission to go, okay, I can do this. Because, you know, if you walk for 10, 15, stop, walk for 10, stop. Like, it does make a big difference. So in a group situation, that's a lot more doable. And when you're mingling with people, because there's a lot of swapping and chatting, that really takes your mind off what you're doing and makes it seem a lot less challenging.
For sure. And then you walk side by side. So people open up. When you stop, you get that little break, you take a sip, and then there's fresh energy because there's a new person to converse with, a new person to bounce off, to share a story, to have a laugh, to share a jelly. So that's what makes the day. And you know, it's a lot of it has to do with mindset, going back to my ultra run as well, or regular hiking, that if you believe to achieve. So again, those small steps, but just keeping the mindset positive. I took a group up Berna last weekend, up to the Mourne's, fabulous part of the country. And some of these women had never, that's also 750 metres. They'd never been up that height. But again, with those kind of techniques, they were so chuffed with themselves that they made the effort to get to the top. And they felt just the sense of accomplishment on the way back down, looking at the mountain they climbed. But then the second tip, Claire, would be nutrition. In regards to nutrition, it's important that you would maybe carb load the night before, especially on a long hike like Karen Toohill. So that would mean eating like a high carb meal, some pasta, and not forgetting to take an electrolyte. I've often seen people on the hills and they just get little niggles in the calf of their leg. To prevent a cramp. So lots of water, staying hydrated, and then having lots of food on the day as well, because you'll be stopping for breaks. And we, you know, just to keep energy levels up as well.
So what sort of food do you pack in your bag?
The Humble sandwich is fantastic. Like, it's balanced. It's like in terms of space. So I'd always have a couple of sandwiches. And then I'd make my own trail mix. So maybe some nuts, some salted caramel dark chocolate, some jellies, that just you can nibble on, because you don't essentially want to eat a huge feed. As you know, all the blood will go to your stomach for digestion and away from the legs. You want to keep your blood moving through the legs. So kind of small snacks, the likes of maybe when you cover a nice medjool date with dark chocolate, fill it with peanut butter and then a bit of sea salt. That's a fabulous little snack. And in Shulin, and I'm sure in Focus Ireland, there are different groups going out. It's lovely when people bake something. And then again, it's a topic of conversation. You can share treats. And yeah, just that we're not relying on jellies all day. Fruit is great as well. Dried mango, those kind of foresty snacks that you can get in Super Value are also amazing.
Yeah, no, the person with the banana bread is always your best friend. So yeah, if you want to make friends, bring a loaf and chop it into little squares and share. Ryan, any more top tips?
Yeah, so safety. So maybe even having a power bank, or even just maybe where you're with Focus Ireland or with a group, you're going to be okay. But having your phone, maybe telling someone where you're going, the likes of Hiker app to track your hike. And maybe this is more relevant to people who are going out alone, but just to let people know where they're going, to use maybe to track, because it's so easy to become disorientated on the hills, even in good visibility. So Hiker app is an Irish owned app, and you can kind of press start and record where you're going, and then you can track where you've been. Looking at the weather as well, because, you know, there's blue skies in Kilkenny today. That doesn't necessarily mean it'll be blue skies all day, every day. So again, going back to my first point of gear, saying, do I need wet gear today? You know, how is the weather going to change? Just so you remain comfortable as well. And the likes of YR weather is fantastic. There's an app called Windy, which is great. And then Alan Carlo Weatherman is also fantastic and very accurate. So just checking in on the weather.
But keep the mindset positive is the real thing I'm going to take from it. You know, you're well able if you've signed up first. There was something in you that felt you could. Few walks, being well dressed and well stocked in your backpack, and you'll be fine.
I think so. Yeah. And just to enjoy the experience. We have a beautiful country, and it's just it's nice to challenge yourself. And at the same time, I've often seen people retreat, and that's OK, too. That's also good mountaineering to go, do you know what? I know my limits here, and I'm happy with what I've done. So it's about being sensible, but also keeping the mindset positive and believing in that you can really, you know, push yourself and achieve. But yeah, it would be great.
Yeah, no, I'm really looking forward to it. So if people want to join me, I am going to hike Carrin Tuil on Saturday, the 15th of June. There's also Crowpatrick is another organised hike on Sunday, the 16th of June, or you can decide on your own challenge. Anything on the move that's raising much needed funds in the fight against homelessness. For more information, log on to focusireland.ie and click on the move button to register. You can find Elaine Nick Raymond on shul_Lynn on Instagram. I'll miss you by my side, but we will hike again soon, my pal. Thank you so much for coming on.
Can I just say one more thing?
You may.
So Mountaineer in Ireland has just released a Happy Hiking series, and I've been very privileged and blessed to be part of the social media campaign. So if you're looking for happy hiking tips, check out Mountaineer in Ireland on Instagram, on their website. They do a free newsletter every week as well, and there's loads of information there.
Fab. And thank you again so much, Elaine. You will find her at shul_Lynn on Instagram. And again, you can register at focusireland.ie and click the On The Move button.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, how tuned in do you feel with what's going on in the world? When it comes to decision making, are you focused and deliberate with the choices you make? Leadership expert, TEDx speaker, and now author Nuala Walsh is urging us to tune in and make smarter decisions in this noisy world. It's the title of her book. Nuala, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
And I think it's something that people are really talking about. We've never had a time when there is so much information. But are we really grasping it and taking it all in? I think it's something people are pondering. Is that what led you to perhaps write the book?
Exactly so. At the end of the day, there is so much. We live in this noisy, distracting, data-driven world, and we can't take in all the information that's out there. And the result is tuned out decision making, tone deaf leaders, if you like, and the results are just catastrophic, particularly if you hold power. So what I've tried to do is to identify the misjudgment traps that happen because of that and draw people's attention to, I guess, mental misinformation. We're all familiar with disinformation and fake news. But what I wanted to do was make people more aware of why they make mistakes and to be more cognizant of what are the traps in these different situations. And then, of course, to provide solutions for them to avoid error and lead better lives and, you know, protect their careers and prevent decision error, not just for themselves, but also for teams in an organisation. And also if you're a power holder, you know, for countries, there are leaders, as we know today, who are making phenomenal mistakes because they're tuned out. And then you have the examples, of course, of polarisation, activism. And this is all because people feel unheard. So people feel unheard, and in many cases, they are unheard because our cognitive ability to process what we hear is so limited, even when we want to and even when we commit to doing so.
There are a lot of issues for the human race at the moment, and you talk about that a little in the introduction, that we talk about economic factors, climate factors, but you think this is one we really need to look at, this understanding human behaviour to avoid bad decision making?
I do. I think human decision risk is one of the most underestimated risks. We all talk about political risk, economic risk, climate risk, as you say, but people don't think about human decision risk as even being related to that. And in some respects, it's because there is this overweighting of what's logical rather than what's psychological. And because people don't fully appreciate the impact that human decision risk and biases have on behaviour, It is a predictable area of human error. And I think if people had a greater understanding of why we make mistakes, you could, A, translate and explain, if you like, the mistakes that people have made in the past, yours and others. And because you understand, you can then prevent error in the future. So it's almost like diagnose before you prescribe. So once you diagnose what's happened and why, you're in a much better position to be able to prevent that error reoccurring in the future.
I was at a talk recently, and it was actually around nutrition, and the lady who was speaking said we make 300 food decisions every day. And that really blew my mind. I mean, how many decisions are we making on a daily basis, and how do we assess what kind of decision maker we are?
Well, actually, scientists have suggested that we make 35,000 decisions every day. Now, I'd hate to be the person who was counting those or even doing the analysis on that, but 95% of those are made unconsciously. So what matters here is the high stakes decision. So it's not about what food you pick in the supermarket, although I do understand that that has healthcare implications, but my focus are the high stakes decisions. Now, if you have a particular illness, of course, it matters. Or if you're really focused on a goal, these things do matter. But for me, the importance here is on being more responsible when you're making these decisions. And how do you know what kind of a decision maker you are? Well, there are various tests you can do, but instinctively you know it too. Are you somebody who rushes to judgment and thinks, always goes with your gut, always decides in an instinctive, automatic manner? Or are you someone who reflects, deliberates? You might have the pros and cons list. And there's a school of thought from Daniel Kahneman who says that's called system one versus the slower version, which is system two. And the biases that we have, you make more errors when you rush to judgment. So, and in this noisy world, of course, that's amplified and you're more at risk of making more of those. So it is a blend. And even though you might slow down and make a decision very slowly, it doesn't mean that you're immune from bias, because you might, for example, be interviewing somebody and you might make a rush to judgment in terms of, you know, drawing a conclusion based on first impressions, whether it's, you know, a radio interview or a hiring interview. And then you use the whole following period to justify that decision. So ex post facto rationalisation, and you use confirmation bias to justify, and jurors do this too, you know, that jurors use this process where you just justify whatever your first impression is. So by definition, whether you decide fast or slow, you're still liable to error. And that's what I've done in the book, as I've pointed to all of these 75 biases across 10 very simple misjudgment traps.
And I suppose if there's ever a decision that we end up regretting or thinking we could have done differently, often we'll say, well, we did the best we could with the information we had at the time. But that's a bit of a cop out, isn't it? And that's why I think it's so interesting that you delve so deeply into the perimeter framework that you've sent out, these pitfalls that we can fall down so that we can be aware of our bias and we can be aware of what may influence us in our decision making, because that gives us a bit more control over that decision.
You're absolutely right. The more you're aware of your tendency, and given that it is a human tendency, in these scenarios, and just to give you a very quick example, one the perimeter is traps, it stands for 10 different factors like power. So power, ego, risk, identity, memory, storytelling, etc. So for example, if you are the power related traps might be you might be looking for power. So you're a graduate and you're looking for your new job. So what decisions are you making because you are influenced by this desire to achieve status and recognition? You might be at the other end of your career and you're looking to retire again, or look, you're desperate to hold on to power. And again, you are subject to different biases. I mean, you only have to look at Trump to see what decisions he made, desperate to hold on to that power. So it's for everyone at every level of the spectrum, career spectrum and age spectrum and gender spectrum, in terms of how liable we are to make these decisions. So that's why these traps are so important. Time is one, another one, you know, when you're in a hurry or when you're too focused on the past, the present or the future, or not focused enough on the past, the present or the future. So, but the good news is that once you're aware of it, you can do something about it and you can control it and you can at least influence it. And as you say, you avoid regret. And the whole thing is about avoiding decision regret and improving decision reward. And although you're not guaranteed to make no mistakes, you are certainly guaranteed to make fewer mistakes and have fewer, less regret if you choose to at least pay attention to some of these factors.
And there's a famous story about Barack Obama that he gave at the talk, that he waits till he gets to 51% with any decision. And that's when he was the president of the United States. And obviously he was making huge decisions that had major impacts on not only his own country, but globally. Mm. And he said, you know, sometimes you get into procrastination, you're never going to be 100% because you don't know the outcome 100%. So he would just wait to 51% and go. And I thought that was really interesting. I think there's sort of a certain amount of haste involved in that almost alarmed me somewhat.
Well, I hadn't heard that before, but he's obviously applied some kind of decision rule. I mean, I'm not sure why 51% is the magic number. I don't think it is the magic number. But, you know, he's had a very good reign and, you know, he's not known for major catastrophes. But people decide those rules. And it's in fact, I know Barack Obama also doesn't like to make routine decisions. So I think he has his wardrobe planned out every day as well. So he doesn't have to think it's a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. So he's obviously, he's a lawyer by background. He's very disciplined in his thinking. So he has set out these decision rules, which reduces his need to think, if you like, because he does all of these things so automatically. But I'm not sure if I was a CEO of an organization that I just wait for, you know, my team to decide 51% on that. But you know, I guess people have different ways of doing it.
And your book is literally jam-packed with research and anecdotes and examples. I said it to you before we went live. It's a huge body of work. And one that really stood out to me was the King's College London attention study. And 47% said they think deep thinking is a thing of the past. That's rather worrying.
It is. And it's a great one that you picked out, actually. It is a real problem because even though we're advocating that people slow down and think strategically and, you know, think more slowly, the fact is we don't have the inclination to do so. We don't have the time to do so because people are running around all the time and don't accord themselves that time. But they're not motivated. And interestingly, they're also not rewarded for doing so. So in a company, you're not rewarded for making a slow decision. So the inbuilt structures and systems in a company are to make fast decisions. And there's a 10-year study also that suggests that people who make faster, quicker decisions are 12 times more likely to reach CEO level. And that was done over 10 years, which is equally as scary as the King's study, which basically, again, shows that people feel that deep thinking is a thing of the past. It's not surprising in this attention-compressed world where, you know, people say to you, give me the benefit of your 50 years in 3 minutes or three words or, you know, Twitter, tell me everything you know in one sentence. So in a reductionist world, everyone wants a soundbite or a slogan or a quick tip, the only tip, you know, the one lesson that you've learned. Well, life isn't like that, I don't think. And decision making certainly isn't, and human behaviour isn't. So you can't narrow everything down to this really tight, monosyllabic single solution. But when we're analysing behaviour, we do want that nugget that to explain. So, for example, if you're looking at even anything in the papers, the British Post Office case, for example, people want one. Was it all about greed, for example, or was it all about self-interest? Human behaviour isn't that simplistic, but we as humans want a simple answer so that we can put it in a box, explain it and move on. So part of this decision making thing is, and that's why the perimeter traps, there are 10 and there are 75 different biases and there is a force multiplier effect. So it's not just one, but even if you know some of them, it's a great start. You're not going to know them all. There are 200 biases actually. But even if you know a few, it is a constant process of learning and you will get better and you will make better decisions for your family or for yourself or for your teams.
And whatever about, I mean, I don't want to say us necessarily, don't want to underestimate your brilliant brain, Nuala, but, you know, the ordinary person on the street making decisions every day will benefit from this. But do we need to worry about the powers that be that are making decisions on our behalf? Are they coming up against the same biases and pitfalls that we are?
This is for everybody, Claire. This is, and they are as guilty. The problem is, there is a greater consequentiality at scale when they get it wrong. So we get it wrong, you know, we get the wrong healthcare decisions or financial decisions. We pay the price personally and so do our families. But countries, leaders, organisations, stakeholders, more people pay the price when it's done with the powers that be. But all of us can control and have a better life when we do this. So my sister asked me, she said, when I was doing the book, she said, oh, this isn't for me. This is just for business people. I said, no, this is for everybody. My mother is 85 and is reading this now. God love her. She keeps going through the same chapters, but she's trying. And she is at least trying to say, well, how do I apply this? This is for everybody in every scenario because we all make decisions. Yes, there is a degree of consequentiality with decisions based on what power you hold. But as a parent, if you pay attention to any of these, and I have quite a few examples of parents who've got it wrong, desperate to do the right thing for their children, they're certainly in there and they're subject to different biases, whether it wasn't power in this case, you know, it could be identity or ego or ethics. Or following the crowd. What are the neighbours doing? What are the school moms doing? You know, following that group and again, making the wrong decisions that, of course, they see in hindsight. No one thinks they're making a bad decision at the time. We all think we're getting it right when we're making a decision. But there is good news, Claire. We do get more right than wrong. Otherwise, you know, we would live in absolute chaos. So of those decisions, and I do think that, I do talk about that in my TED talk, people face indecision. But the good news is we get more right than wrong. But when we get it wrong, there is a price to be paid, whether it's you or whether it's other people. And that's the responsibility here, to do your best to get it right.
Yeah, let's slow down, bring that awareness and keep deep thinking. The book is called Tune In, How to Make Smarter Decisions in a Noisy World. Nuala Walsh, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you very much, Claire.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, did you know that baby formula is one of the most shoplifted items from grocery shelves? And were you also aware that the price of formula has skyrocketed by a third over the last 3 years? Ellen Coyne wrote on the subject for the Irish Independent recently, and she joins me on the line now. Ellen, you're very welcome.
Thank you so much.
So, Ellen, you do believe it came across very clearly in your article that the breast is best policy has stopped people being able to have a debate on why these prices are skyrocketing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think that basically the evidence, when you look at it, is beyond dispute. The prices of formula have risen by over 30% over the last number of years. If you're someone who uses formula, it will absolutely be the most expensive item in your grocery basket every week. And formula poverty is a very serious issue because it's making people take risks by further diluting formula, and it's a threat to baby nutrition. But whenever I or politicians or others have tried to speak about this, talking about formula being too expensive is immediately being framed as a threat to breastfeeding policy. And I think that sometimes that rhetoric goes a little bit too far. And in listening to it, you would almost think that the use of formula is a kind of like a moral wrong by women, or formula when it's used to feed babies, and it is a life-saving form of infant nutrition, is always framed as nothing but the the failure of a breastfeeding policy. And people, it's impossible to get people in power to talk about the things that we should be doing to cut the price of formula, an essential food item, which has gone way beyond and over the top of the normal rates of inflation, because people are so obsessed with doing anything that kind of offends our laudable pursuit of better breastfeeding rates. And I think that it's not a zero-sum game.
You spoke about Labour Senator Rebecca Moynihan, and she tried to get the Competition and Consumer Protection Commission to launch an investigation into the price of formula, and she was very much brushed off. And you found it difficult to find someone else that was willing to put their head above the parapet and take on this topic.
Yeah, I mean, Rebecca Moynihan has kind of been nearly an isolated figure in Irish politics and trying to push this to the top of the agenda. And her idea of trying to get the competition watchdog to look into this was a good one, because in the UK last year, they also noticed that the prices of formula were going way beyond the rates of inflation and seemed to be rising at a rate that was unsustainable for some families. And that competition watchdog did launch an investigation and it did take action. And that actually saw some brands cutting the price of their formula. Now, those are brands that are also available on Irish shelves, and we never saw a similar cut in formula prices over here. So it was a very laudable idea, and I suppose they kind of struggled with the competition watchdog's response that it didn't seem to believe that this merited an investigation. And even like when people like Rebecca Moynihan or some of her colleagues kind of put down parliamentary questions, ask questions to the Irish Department of Health, you'll get back reams and reams of an answer that talks again about how important breastfeeding is, how low our breastfeeding rates are. Like when a woman finds herself in a supermarket aisle looking at these high prices of formula, a box of which can be the bones of €20, it's too late then to be talking about breastfeeding formula. It's too late to be talking about breastfeeding. You know, formula is a valid choice. It's a choice that people make for very good reasons. And I think that it's silly and crazy that a government that consistently tries to convince us that it understands people's pressures and understands the cost of living is refusing to talk about the most influential grocery cost in a lot of people's baskets.
Now, I think this is a topic that you would have taken on, be you a mother or not, because this is your investigative journalist hat on, and it's a topic that should be discussed and highlighted. But you do also talk in the piece about your experience as a mother, and not only the lack of support that was there for breastfeeding when you left the maternity hospital, but also the reaction and vitriol you have received online when you do discuss this subject.
Yeah, so I had a baby, my first baby in 2021, and it was in the middle of a level 5 lockdown. So I was in a hospital that is under-resourced and overworked. And I think I got a couple of minutes with a lactation consultant, and I was having issues with latching. So I did end up doing a mix of expressing and formula use, and eventually kind of graduated on to using formula exclusively. But I always felt, you know, that there is like a huge stigma about it. Sometimes it seems like it's the last publicly acceptable way to shame women, and people do it under the guise of breast is best. Obviously, having a baby in lockdown, as anyone else who went through it would know, like, you really did end up on an island. And one of the only times you could talk to other women or other mothers was online. And, you know, those WhatsApp groups, Facebook groups, they can be a great help, but the rhetoric and shaming around the use of formula can be very strong as well. And any time I could see women talking about their issues with formula, the response would only be to know, you know, not give up on your breastfeeding journey just yet. And even later on, earlier this year, when again Rebecca Moynihan pointed out that according to research carried out by the CSO, the price of formula seemed to have been rocketing over the last couple of years, writing about that, some of the responses and comments online, which I know are often, you know, not regarded as kind of the highest form of debate anyway, were septic. Like, people were, women were claiming that the only reason that other women use formula is so that they can kind of have their Friday night wines because they're lazy or because they're too thick to know that breastfeeding, quote unquote, is free. I would reject all of that, especially the claim that breastfeeding is free. In my experience, breastfeeding could often require the very expensive use of a lactation consultant, which is a resource that isn't available to everyone, because our lactation supports in hospitals are very hard to come by because those hospitals aren't given the resources that they want. So I think there's a particular kind of madness and cruelty in setting up a maternity system that makes it very difficult for people who have issues with breastfeeding to get the support they need, and then blaming women when they find themselves in that supermarket aisle, which is subject to more scrutiny and surveillance than any other part of the supermarket, including the off-license, because they are desperate to feed a starving baby, and because the pressure is having a real impact on their postnatal mental health.
Yeah, for sure. Why can't we step away from this stigma and have a proper reasoned debate and discussion? Well, I want to bring in paediatrician and neonatologist Afif Al-Kufash. He's also the presenter of the Baby Tribe podcast. Afif, you're very welcome. It's lovely to have you back.
And I'm delighted to be back. Thank you.
And I remember when I had kids 10 years ago, I mean, I used to go online and I'd look up, you know, forums for, you know, feeding, night feeding, how often is your kid sleeping, are you baby-led weaning? And yes, you'd find a little bit of differing information, and eventually I'd have to kind of drill down into my own intuition and my own baby's cues and get on with it. But in that decade, it's exploded now with social media and this sort of self-comparison. It can be a very tricky place for people.
Absolutely. And you've touched on so many different things that we need to address. I mean, first of all is the fact that, you know, mothers begin to compare themselves with other mothers, other families on social media. And, you know, this particular thing may have worked for a certain family at a certain time. It don't necessarily work, you know, for the person looking at it. And then the other thing you're looking at is if you're actually trying to find out some information, even on, you know, formula, what type of formula suits my baby, how much formula should my baby take? If you actually do a Google search, the first 10 lines on the search engine are actually sponsored by formula companies. And I firmly believe that they're not giving you evidence-based, unbiased advice. They're all trying to send you their own product, right? And trying to actually figure out evidence-based information from information that is trying to promote a certain product is actually impossible, sometimes even for me, when I'm trying to prepare for example, my podcast, The Baby Tribe, where we talk about, you know, all different kinds of feeding. I sometimes find it a challenge to find evidence-based information on what I want to cover. I'm bombarded with ads. I'm bombarded with all different kinds of formula. And it sometimes leaves me a little bit confused, and it takes me such a long time to actually figure out what is evidence and what isn't. And the problem is we don't have a lot of evidence for a lot of the advertised different formula types. And I sometimes think that they are almost created to confuse, because even if you look at the first formula, the basic formula that is really the only formula that is actually needed over the first year of age, you see so many different varieties: Gold, Advanced. You have now new ones that are specific for cesarean section mothers. You have the comfort formulas. And how can a parent actually figure out what is best? And sometimes I feel that parents feel that if they actually pick the basic standard formula, that they may be doing their baby a disservice by not picking one that has the word advanced after it or gold after it. And if you actually drill down into the data, a lot of those claims about, you know, variable formats of the formula, if you like, are completely unsubstantiated. And that has been looked at systematically in a lot of recent research, because there are very tight restrictions on the makeup of formulas and how they are made. Even when you look at the organic formulas that are all coming out now, for example, it gives you the impression, gosh, you know, if there is an organic version, then the standard version must have a higher level of pesticides. So maybe I'll have to actually use the organic formula because I want to do the best that I can do for my baby. But when you actually look at the European Union's rules, even the standard formula must have zero detectable rates of pesticides. So the organic formula in that sense doesn't actually give you an advantage over the standard formula. And it's sometimes 2, 3, 4, 5 euros more expensive, and it can build up over time. So what I aim to do is to break all of this down for parents so that they can make informed choices for their babies. And that's just the formula aspect, you know?
And do we have enough research into formula? Because I often talk on the show about the lack of female-focused evidence that we have when it comes to health research. And it must be the same with babies, infants and children, because it's quite hard to put newborns into a clinical trial.
You've hit the nail on the head there. The problem with trying to do systematic research in terms of formula is that you can't really randomize babies into using formula versus breastfeeding, for example, because that's unethical. So we largely depend on observational studies, meaning that we observe parents or families using certain types of formula and we go and look at the outcomes down the line. And that in itself can have inherent problems, is usually the two groups that you're comparing aren't actually the same in so many other ways. Yet people, for example, don't look at that. An example of what I've just said is when you look at studies comparing the benefits of breastfeeding, for example, in comparison to formula, and you go and look at whatever outcome you want to look at down the line, how well you do in school, how smart you are, whatever metric you use, on the surface, it looks like babies that are exposed to breastfeeding during the early years tend to do far better in those outcomes. What a lot of studies don't do is actually take into account other factors that may contribute to those outcomes.
Of which there are many.
So many. How engaged you are with your parents, how attentive the parents are.
Socioeconomic factors.
Oh, so many different things. And when you adjust for these factors, the gap or the difference in outcome between breastfeeding and formula aren't that big. Formula is slightly lower than breastfeeding, but the gap is so much lower. And those pieces of information are good on a global scale, but they are almost useless on an individual level, you know? So that's what I tell my parents when, for example, a mom comes in feeling guilty because her breastfeeding journey did not work. I go through these things that we've just discussed, to try and alleviate, you know, feelings of guilt, feelings that they haven't done their baby, you know, a good service. And, you know, having that information often improves the relationship they have with their baby down the line.
Do you think we need to change the breastfeeding message? Because it is still out there that breast is best and there is a lot of judgment. And yet we don't have the support there to help new moms take on breastfeeding because it's not easy. And I remember myself really struggling with it because it's sold this most natural, beautiful connection that's just going to fly and you and your baby are going to head off into this utopia together on a cloud. And then the reality is it's painful, it's difficult, it's stressful. Your life has literally just been turned upside down. I think if people talked about it a little bit more and there were more supports, I was lucky that I could pay a lactation consultant to come to the house afterwards because I was still panicking about the whole situation. And I had a friend who said, just keep ringing that bell in the hospital and asking every single time for help and don't be worrying about annoying them. But I did feel like they were under pressure. I did feel, even though I had such a beautiful experience at the maternity hospital, that there wasn't necessarily somebody there to help me one-on-one. Do we really need to change how we're talking and supporting feeding our babies?
So we're great at telling people, as you said, that breastfeeding is best, but where we fail is to actually put in the supports and managing expectations of the difficult nature of establishing breastfeeding for a large number of mums over the first few days. It's not natural. It doesn't come naturally to you. It's not something that you can just, it doesn't work, immediately. Sometimes the baby is learning, the mother is learning, and a big key in establishing a good breastfeeding relationship is the support over the first few days in the maternity hospital or in the maternity setting. Just to give you an example, in the Irish context, 80% of first-time mothers intend on breastfeeding, which is a big figure. By the time they leave the hospital 3 days later, that figure drops down to 40% are leaving the hospital exclusively breastfeeding. So half of the mothers that are intending on breastfeeding leave the hospital using formula. So a big drop off over the first few days. And where does it come from? I think the biggest issue is the lack of staffing. And I suppose there is still a culture in Irish maternity hospitals of being very quick with suggesting formula or pushing formula when the initial breastfeeding journey isn't working. And I think the root cause of this is the fact that we are understaffed. We don't have time to sit down and spend 10, 15, 20 minutes with a mum. Just to give you, put that in context, you know, our midwives, who are amazing, angels on earth.
Angels.
Absolutely. You know, you could have a midwife that's looking after 10 mother and baby pairs. Now, how can that poor midwife actually give good breastfeeding support to every single one of them while also carrying out all their duties?
Yeah. And I've had several friends told that's a hungry baby, which infers that you're never going to be able to feed that baby with your own milk. So formula is inevitable. I think that's quite a loaded sentence.
I'm so glad that you brought this up. And I'll give you a quick anecdote of the contrasting experiences we had with our two kids. One was born here and one was born in Canada. You met them both. So my daughter that was born here was struggling with breastfeeding, and the midwife came in and it said those exact words to us. And now I'm a pediatrician, my wife's an anaesthetist. We both have knowledge in the medical field, and I was a senior pediatric trainee at the time. But hearing that my daughter was hungry instilled so much guilt into us. All we wanted to do was offer her a formula to, you know, make that hunger go away. Fast forward 2.5 years later, same exact challenges my daughter had and my son was having with latching. The midwife in Toronto walked in and said, look how eager he is to feed. Isn't that great? Let's try and get him to feed. Same exact situation, two completely different attitudes. And my son's breastfeeding journey was a lot more successful than my daughter's. So those first few days are so crucial. The words we use, the actions we take are so important.
However, we started this conversation talking about formula, and I think people will feel their shoulders go down to hear a pediatrician and a newborn expert saying, talking about formula, and that it is okay, it's fine, we need to stop having this pressure. Because also, as someone who breastfeeding worked out for, I was almost scared of formula, and I completely, which is, you know, not necessarily something I regret, but I completely almost chained myself to both of my babies for months on end instead of taking necessary breaks at times, or, you know, taking a night away. And, you know, these are just all things that we need to be able to talk about, and there needs to be an openness about that, you know, breastfeeding is good, formula is good, feeding your baby and being as relaxed and supported as a parent is the ultimate goal.
Claire, there are some people out there that would make you think that you're almost poisoning your child by giving them a bottle of formula. And I remember I contributed to an Irish Times article just as COVID was starting all this time ago, saying we should ditch the guilt with formula feeding, introducing formula while you're breastfeeding, if you choose to do so, to manage whatever you want to manage is fine. There's no health implications to it. And it's not going to jeopardize the breastfeeding relationship once it's established, if that it is what works for you. What I find is that if a mum feels under so much pressure to continue the breastfeeding relationship, fearing that formula may cause harm if she introduces it for whatever reason she wants to do that, I think that compromises the breastfeeding relationship even further, you know? And we need to meet in the middle. I hate the term exclusive breastfeeding. I hate the term exclusive formula feeding. As you said, we should just treat families on an individual basis and advocate the best feeding approach that works for them, because that's how you ensure good outcomes, right? If you have a mother that's so depressed, that is under so much stress because she is struggling with breastfeeding for whatever reason, finding it difficult, finding it hard, all she can do mentally is actually just breastfeed her baby and then ignores all the other important things like engaging with your baby, like talking to your baby, like spending quality time with your baby, then that baby's outcome isn't going to be great if you compare it to a mom that have introduced a bottle of formula, enabled her to maintain the breastfeeding journey for maybe longer, you know, because she felt that she had the freedom and she had other options to be able to maintain what she wants to do. You know, that's the balance that we need to talk about, and that's not really being mentioned a lot.
And I want to bring back in journalist Ellen Coyne. If people are listening to this and they want to show their support for this a little bit more, how can they? How can we push for change in this area?
Well, I think that one of my biggest bugbears with this is that the burden of advocating for affordable formula, and that's what I'm talking about. I'm not advocating for formula. I'm not advocating against breastfeeding. I'm advocating for something that's crucial to an infant survival to be affordable. The burden seems to fall on women who use formula or feel strongly about this issue, or in the case of Rebecca Moynihan, are brave enough to take it on. I actually think that this is a cost of living issue. This is a household budgeting issue, and it's one that's disproportionately affecting poorer women and women who are new parents, and men as well, of course. So I think that if people care about this, it's certainly something that they should be talking to their public representatives about. They should be talking to politicians who particularly claim to care, to be passionate about issues around women, maternity services, mothers and babies, because I think that this is something that should, while people might only use formula for a brief amount of time, it could be hugely influential and hugely stressful on you if something as important as baby formula is something that you can't afford.
Well, I'd love to hear your thoughts, Alive and Kicking at newstalk.com. But journalist Ellen Coyne and neonatologist and paediatrician Afif Al-Kufash, thank you so much for coming on.
So that's it for Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Aidan McKelvey, and Hugo Da Silva Scott, who was on sound. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on Newstalk.